The topic of this national town meeting, when should America use nuclear weapons? The principal speakers will be Congresswoman Patricia Schroeder, Democrat of Colorado, and Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, former Chief of Naval Operations. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These national town meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished speakers from various fields, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at the Kennedy Center, some of the most important subjects of the day. And now, the moderator of this national town meeting, Helen Thomas of United Press International.
Good morning, you brave souls, and welcome to National Town Meeting. It's an honor for me to introduce two speakers today who are best known for bucking the system and surviving. More than that, they've made points, daring to be different and challenging the old ways of doing things with new, exciting ideas, all in the realm of the possible. But both have also worked within the system and gained enough power to make the country sit up and take notice. Our first speaker, Pat Schroeder, is a Democratic congresswoman from Colorado who gives the curmudgeon chairman of the House Armed Services Committee fits. When he grudgingly acquiesced to her membership on that formidable all-male bastion, he said, "All right, she can be house mother. Some house. Some mother." She's been called a skinny Bella Abzug. And her campaign brochure with her picture is captioned, "This radical troublemaker is out to get something from you, hope." To some generals and admirals, she is the enemy. The woman who wants to cut the sacrosanct defense budget to spread the money around to social programs that meet the nation's human needs. She has the audacity to think that if you have a nuclear arsenal to blow up the world 5 times, you don't have to do it 17 times. Her academic record is impressive. Phi Beta Kappa, a magna cum laude degree from the University of Minnesota, Harvard Law School. Before taking the plunge into politics, she was a labor lawyer. Her husband is an attorney, and she has 2 young sons, sons she'd like to grow up in a safe world. She's not afraid to think the unthinkable. So we ask Representative Schroeder, when should America use nuclear weapons, and I might add, why?
Thank you very much. It's very difficult to tackle that topic in 2 minutes, especially when I have trouble ordering a cheese sandwich in 2 minutes. But I think this is one of these questions that we're really asking ourselves, and that is, can we survive our own technology? We've had that debate going on for an incredibly long period of time. And very recently, it's all been reinstigated with the talk of counterforce, and what does that mean, and tactical nuclear weapons, and how we're going to have a clean nuclear war, and how we're all going to have everyone in the war being very rational, and they aren't going to overreact, and we'll just shoot a few of their targets, and they'll just shoot a few of our targets. And every now and then you shake your head and think, my word, we've all lost our minds. The question of when should the United States use nuclear weapons? I don't think any of us would have any problem with that if we had somebody invading on a beachhead or something in our own country. We probably would figure it's the last ditch stand, and at that point, what have you got to lose? But going beyond that, there's some very, very difficult questions we have to ask. Some of the questions that I've been asking on the Armed Services Committee is, why aren't we making sure our conventional forces are much stronger so we don't get in a corner, so that we don't suddenly say, oh my word, we're going to lose this war unless we suddenly go to tactical nuclear weapons? I think if we had a much stronger conventional force, we wouldn't have to be compromising or wouldn't have to be worrying about a lot of the things that we've been discussing. When you talk about tactical nuclear weapons, you're making a difference between the tactical and the strategic. When you say tactical, you usually mean something you're going to win a battle with, something that you're not going to hit the enemy's homeland with, but rather you're going to hit his battlefield with. The strategic would be our long-ranged missiles that are in submarines, that are on the ground here, that could fire and go all the way to Russia. So much of this becomes rhetoric. So as I say, when we try and take nuclear weapons, which most of us think of as being strategic and going from our country to Russia or from our submarines to Russia, then we have this intermediate thing where you have nuclear weapons that are supposedly only going to be used on the battlefield. Now, we've had those for quite some time, and one of the main places that we have talked about using them is in Europe. What happens because we feel that there's a conventional imbalance between the Warsaw Pact and between the NATO countries. And so it's conceivable that if Russia ever decided to move on Europe, we might be in instant trouble. Should we use the tactical nuclear weapons in that instance? Now that becomes very, very frightening. Because if we do use it in that instance to save the NATO armies, couldn't it be, isn't it foreseeable then that Russia would not just come back at us on an equal basis, but escalate a little more? Hasn't the history of war usually been the history of escalation, and we might suddenly be in a strategic exchange? The other thing that's very, very concerning to me about all the new counterforce tactics, which are now going to be applied to our strategic forces, and that is to make our land-based missiles much more surgical, so they would have a 99% hit chance on a hard target, which means the Russian missile silos. On a hard target, you have to hit it, and you have to hit it almost directly to make sure you destroy it. Now, it seems to me if I were a Russian, I would be saying, why would they fire those at our empty silos? So they would be getting, if I were a Russian and heard some of the dialogue going on in this country about what we want to do with our weapon systems and how we want to improve it, I would think if they are going to spend that much money and they already have three times the number of strategic weapons that Russia has, if they're going to spend that much money making those weapons even more precise, then I think we have made the world much more uneasy. Because it seems that if I were a Russian, I'd be much more tempted to launch my weapons on warning. And once they're out of the shot, once they're out of the silo, they're out of the silo. But the thought being, if something is coming at you, you better get your missiles off because they might wipe them off if they're 99% effective. So I think we should be talking about how we can make the possibility of unleashing this horrendous technology we've created, how we can tone it down rather than crank it up. I don't think we want to get in a nuclear chess game, and I don't think we want to be rattling our nuclear muscle or showing our nuclear muscle to the Russians. The one thing that the Secretary of Defense and other people have always said is the Russians have never told us they would engage in a mini-nuke war. They've always said, once we start it, it's a nuclear war. It only takes one person to start it, but it takes several people to stop it. That's very important. We also know that in the history of the United States in 200 years, we've killed a million and a half civilians. A million and a half American civilians and military people, I should say. But that's in 200 years. We now know, as of last week, they said that the estimates for what would happen if we had a, quote, mini-nuke exchange, that we would kill somewhere between 1.5 to 22 million people in this country, which is to me, just totally unthinkable, totally unacceptable. And it's also based on the premise that each side is going to be very reasonable and will just exchange a few targets. And as I say, I really think your command and control goes very shortly. All sorts of things can transpire. So while I would like to be able to spend 30 minutes outlining the things that I think are very key, I hope we get into that with the questions. I think the main thing we should be doing is concentrating on conventional weapons and doing everything we can to lower the fire break between conventional and strategic weapons rather than blurring that line between the two and hoping that everybody remains reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Congresswoman Schroeder. Our next speaker is Elmo Russell Zumwalt, a retired admiral whom we hear is testing the political waters to see whether he can sink the entrenched Byrd family in Virginia to win a Senate seat from that state. During his memorable tour of duty as Chief of Naval Operations, he put a lot of ships in mothballs and tried his best to keep only the best afloat. But he shook up the Navy traditionalists, are there any other kind, by throwing some of the regulations overboard, permitting long hair on sailors, billeting women on ships of the line, and broadening the opportunities for black seamen. With this kind of a record, we don't know what he would have done about the topless wonder, Cat Futch, or the speaker, but we can imagine. He was born in San Francisco and was graduated from the Naval Academy with honors. He served in three wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. His decorations fill a page, single-spaced. The former Navy whiz kid is now president of Americans for Energy Independence, and his concern over the energy crisis is 50 fathoms deep. He also questions the sincerity of détente and its chief proponent, Henry Kissinger, and he's trying to send an SOS to America to be alert to any pitfalls. Unlike some of his ex-Pentagon colleagues, he did not come out of the genie bottle, but he is one of the nation's experts in the sophisticated technology of modern warfare and the balance of terror that's called peace. I'm delighted to introduce Admiral Zumwalt and to ask him, when should America use nuclear weapons? Admiral Zumwalt.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. I've been worrying how I could debate with my good friend, the lovely Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to have a debate after listening to her. In any discussion of the use of nuclear weapons, we are already making a hidden assumption. That assumption is that there has been a failure of policy by both superpowers. Soviet policy is to shift the correlation of forces in their favor for the purpose of ensuring that Soviet hegemony continues to expand and U.S. influence continues to retract. By shifting the correlation of forces, the Soviets refer to achieving superiority over the United States in the fields of military power, economic power, psychological advantages, national morale and will, technology, and so forth. They see this shift, and they write about it daily in their papers, and their leaders talk about it, in this shift in the correlation of forces, as gradually achieving the dissolution of U.S. alliances, the Finlandization of Europe, the radicalization of the underdeveloped world, the economic degradation of the free world, and increasing recognition of the Soviet Union as the world's single superpower. The Soviet leadership judges that careful, rational pursuit of these aims can lead to their realization without war. They would clearly consider war, and explicitly the use of nuclear weapons by either side, as a miscalculation. The purpose of their recently achieved strategic nuclear superiority and the purpose of their achieved superiority in conventional military forces is to prevent war and to ensure that the United States accommodates slowly and carefully to to Soviet objectives. Similarly, the United States has sought to maintain a policy of supporting, in our case, a stable world order and community through the use of influence, economic power, and sufficient military strength in both the strategic nuclear field and in the conventional field to prevent the Soviet military action against the United States and her allies, and to be able to deter potentially aggressive regimes like those of North Korea. Regrettably, the major cuts in defense budgets by the Congress over the last 6 or 7 years have made it possible for the Soviet Union to outspend the United States in the strategic field by 60% and in the conventional field by from 20 to 25%. Thus, Soviet military superiority continues to grow, and they are using this superiority to weaken the political and economic structure of the free world. The cuts that the Congress has made in our conventional military forces makes it increasingly less likely that the free world can win a conventional war, and therefore increasingly less likely that the United States and the free world will resort to a conventional war. And regrettably, somewhere down the road, 1978, 1980, a president of the United States will face the awful choice of making a major accommodation to Soviet demands or of considering the use of nuclear weapons. I, for one, am deeply grateful that I will never have to be in a position of making that decision when the time comes. I look forward to your questions.
I was afraid he was going to announce for the presidency. Add one more candidate to the... Well, I think they both agree that there should be a buildup in conventional weaponry and forces. I'd like to have the privilege of asking the first question to both speakers. What do each of you think of the current negotiations with the Soviet Union on strategic arms limitation? And do you think it's going in the right direction? Should there be an agreement?
I really have not been impressed, to be very honest, with what's been going on in SALT. I see them putting caps on so that both sides can rise up to some sort of equivalent. I don't really see it stopping the arms race. I see it launching it in all sorts of new directions. I think if we were really serious, we would start cutting back. I think we should be very firm about on-site inspection in Russia. And until we get on-site inspection, I'm not sure any of it's worth the paper it's written on. I think when we talk about tactical nuclear weapons and we look at SALT, I think both of us would be in agreement. We don't know exactly what kind of tactical nuclear weapons the Russians have. We haven't seen them. We're not really sure. We're making a lot of guesses. So I think a lot of it, I think, has been more political hoopla than it really has been arms control. And if anything, it's probably caused us to fly off in many other directions and allowed the Soviets to rise to where we were before we started.
Admiral, can you speak on the subject?
I have very similar views. In my judgment, the SALT negotiations have not been arms control negotiations. I came to that subject as one who had had some experience in the arms control field as director of arms control back during the period when we were negotiating the test ban, and I learned there firsthand that if one is tough in his demands, unwilling to buy unreasonable Soviet positions, that it is possible to achieve a fair and balanced agreement, as was done in the case of the test ban. During the strategic arms limitation talks, the Soviet position was here, the U.S. position was here, and the negotiation went like this, and when we got here, we had a deal. We merely put a limit on the Soviet plan. That is, we gave them the right to build everything that they could possibly have built during the 5 years of the interim offensive agreement. We, on the other hand, did not even try to match that massive building program. And so we have given the Soviets the right through negotiation to have nuclear strategic superiority, and further, the Congress, having been briefed on the nature of those deals, having been briefed on the nature of the anti-ballistic missile treaty on the one hand and the interim offensive agreement on the other, a deal which consisted of some written agreements backed up by some bilateral understandings of both sides, backed up further by unilateral declarations on the part of the United States as to what they would and would not accept, the Congress has never been informed by the administration that the Soviet Union is cheating on the basic deal, has violated the bilateral understandings, and has violated the unilateral declarations as to behavior that we would not accept.
And now we're delighted to invite our audience to question our speakers. There are floor mics available in the far right and left aisles. Please give your name and to whom you are addressing the question. And while you're getting to the mics, I'd like to ask some of the questions that have been sent up here. It's addressed to Admiral Zumwalt. Could small tactical nuclear weapons have ended the Vietnam War sooner? And what are the odds that the USSR would have retaliated in kind?
Well, in my judgment, the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the Vietnam War would have been very unwise indeed. The real question to debate is, of course, whether or not we should have gone in the first place. I think the overwhelming number of military men felt that we should not have, that it was a war in a period of colonialism where we had no vital interests, where we did not have allies that we were obligated to support, and that the decision nevertheless having been made to go in, then there was a real debate with regard to what kind of military strategy ought to be used. I believe that many, many more Americans were killed and many, many more billions of dollars were spent than needed to have been spent had the military strategy been to apply conventional military force against North Vietnam rather than to try to fight the very inefficient war in the jungles that was fought. But I would never have advocated the use of tactical nuclear weapons because I agree with Congresswoman Schroeder that you may have a particular approach or concept in mind when you cross that nuclear threshold, but you certainly cannot assume that the other side will have a similar set of firebreaks in mind.
I'd like to concur, and I'd like to thank you for saying that, because I think General Westmoreland has been known to say that maybe we should have used tactical nuclear weapons in that instance, so I'm glad to hear that you wouldn't agree. I think the odds are just too high as to where we end up.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to take the question from the person on the right microphone.
My name is Gary Barron, and I'd like to ask my question to Admiral Zumwalt. Admiral, do you feel that the European leaders should be consulted and have the veto power over the initial NATO use of nuclear weapons in the event of a USSR invasion of Western Europe? If not, why?
My own view is that European leadership should be in on any decision to use nuclear weapons in Europe, because that is, after all, their political problem as to whether or not they prefer to survive, if one can use that strange word in discussion of a nuclear war, or whether they prefer merely to let themselves be overrun, as they inevitably would without the use of nuclear weapons. The basic problem that I think most Americans are not yet aware of is that we no longer have the conventional power in the free world to withstand a Soviet invasion of Europe. We no longer have the conventional power ourselves to come to the assistance of Europe in a purely conventional context. This is why I think your two speakers today have both expressed great concern about that tragic reduction in conventional military power, because that would be the logical decision for everybody to agree upon. Fight the Soviets with conventional power if they invade, and try to seek, as gas was never used in World War II, never to use nuclear weapons. The only reason the issue will ever arise is because we have let our conventional defenses down.
I think one of the things that we might do in NATO, too, is I think we should be much firmer about getting a better command system in NATO. I think that there really has been great problems in coordinating and commanding the NATO forces, and it's been in the press for a long time. And I think that trying to ever get everybody together to make a decision on whether or not to use tactical nuclear weapons when we know we've got over 7,000 deployed in Europe and some of them are like 18 miles from the border, you're really going to be making some awfully fast decisions. I would question whether in NATO we should have tactical nuclear weapons deployed that close to the border, because I'm not sure how you get everybody together and quick make those decisions if they were suddenly about to be overrun. And my understanding is if one ever goes off, you have incredible problems with radar and your command and control, and you start spiraling downward and trying to coordinate it. But I think we need to work that problem through a lot more. It's been very diplomatic, and we've been very hesitant to really say we've got to get this thing organized so it'll work. We've started to make a little bit of an inroad that way, but I think we've got a long way to go.
And now for a questioner on our left.
Yeah, my name, Carlos Van Leer, Navy veteran, World War II, to Admiral Zumwalt and Congressman Schroeder. We are giving psychiatric examinations to women who would kill one person, the president. Why not psychiatric examinations for nuclear weaponry advocates who would kill them by the million? And especially to overkill enthusiasts who would kill the same corpses over and over again.
Well, I guess the first comment I would make is that I would welcome psychiatric examinations for all, including the Soviet leadership, which continues to have its aggressive designs. If we could start with them, I'd be willing to submit to all others to the similar process. Seriously, the problem has, I think, been pretty well outlined, but it is important to make one additional comment, and that is the conventional wisdom is, as you have just articulated it, that we can kill the Russians 5 times or 7 times, so why kill them 20 times? The actual fact, in my judgment, based on years of study, years of analysis of the war games, is that if you will buy 2 assumptions we do not have today, the capability to overkill. Those assumptions are that the Russians will always strike first, and that the Russians are not producing civil defense manuals and are not stocking food and water in their forests and caverns and are not putting industry underground with the intention not to use it. That if they do strike first, they will evacuate their cities. And when one runs the calculations on that basis, you find that while the United States is losing from 100 million to 160 million of its citizens, the Soviet Union would lose only 10 million. Now, I would never suggest that our decision ought to be to go to nuclear war, even if we had a superiority in the numbers that we would kill. What I am suggesting is that that president in 1978 or 1980 who has to make the choice as between major accommodation and using nuclear weapons is going to be told by his military advisors at the time that those are the differences in the population kill. And now ask yourself as president what your decision would be.
I would have to say that maybe one of the things you don't understand is the planners are trying to save you by destroying you. And I think that that's kind of the madness that we get into sometimes. It's in order to save you, we must destroy you, because otherwise we may not be able to save you, which is bizarre. I think it's clear that both sides, neither side, I should say, has a first strike capacity. And even Secretary Schlesinger has admitted this, that there is no way we could knock out all the nuclear weapons in Russia so they couldn't retaliate on a first strike, nor is there any way they could come after us. and do that. And we can both inflict incredible damage in a second strike. So that whole thing, to ever get that started, is really almost insanity, and start trying to do the trade-offs. And that's why I think if we're really serious about arms control, we'd start trying to bring down the numbers rather than allow both sides to build up the certain numbers. It just makes no sense.
I would just add one.
It's a beautiful phrase. Conventional wisdom.
Yeah, I understand your point. I think the difference between us is that I've examined the detailed computer outcomes, and my kill estimates are accurate in my judgment. The thing that we have to understand is that we are not going to have those exchanges. We are not going to have 100 to 160 million Americans killed and only 10 million Russians killed in retaliation. What we're going to have instead is the president making the decision that he's got to go along with the Soviet demands in a given crisis. Now, I share Congresswoman Schroeder's view that this is a crazy world. We would be much better off if we were reporting accurately to the people what the facts were, reporting accurately the extent of Soviet cheating, demanding that our grain sales, instead of going in a way that gets nothing for the American taxpayer, were used as part of our bargaining wampum, demanding that our technology, which we are giving them to help them overcome those few areas in which they are behind us militarily, be part of the negotiating wampum, demanding that our trade relationships be part of the negotiating wampum, and we should insist that the Soviet Union, which has only half of our gross national product, but is spending more dollars per year than we are for military capability, greatly reduces expenditures. I would strongly support an effort to reduce the total size of strategic nuclear forces by half or more, if we could get the Soviets to do so in a way that would give true parity and equality, instead of giving them what they demand, nuclear military superiority for use in political blackmail.
Okay. May we have the next question from the left?
I am Ethel Alsop, president of the Organized Women Voters of Arlington, Virginia. And I want to ask Admiral Zumwalt, since Helen Thomas brought up the subject, why he doesn't run for the Senate in California. We have a very good senator, Senator Byrd. He's a lady's son. Ladies, darling, we love it, and I'm afraid you'd be wasting your time and your money, but you could go ahead if you're brave enough. Now then, going back to the other subject, what does CIA intend to do with those poisonous drugs?
I guess with regard to the first point,
the beginning. What did they have them for in the beginning? Kill Americans or the enemies?
I guess with regard to the first question, it sounds like I'm certainly in trouble with a certain segment of the voters in Virginia. And that would be perfectly proper and appropriate in accordance with our system of having vigorous debate of the issues and to provide the best opportunity for Americans to participate and to vote for the person of their choice. If I make the decision to run for the Senate, it would be in the state of Virginia, which has been the state in which I have lived more than any other during the 30 years I was being moved from pillar to post in the service of the United States, and where three of our four children are, and where our roots are. Since, interestingly enough, my original ancestors were first settled in Virginia before adventuresome descendants moved west. The answer to the second question is that I do not know why the CIA had the toxins in the first place, nor why they disobeyed an order in the second place, and I strongly support the decision that all of this should be investigated as part of a continuing search on the part of our Congress into what went wrong with an administration which was corrupt beyond all belief.
May we have the next question? All the questions are on the left, so we'll take it from there.
My name is Rob Means, and Admiral Zumwalt, you've mentioned at least twice that the President in years to come will have a decision to make, either make some accommodation to the Russians or make a commitment to nuclear arms. What kind of accommodation would you foresee that the President would have to use would have to go to the other alternative? I'd like some example or a guideline of some kind.
Sure. Let me discuss three nuclear confrontations through which we've already lived. The first of these was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, when the Soviets were, of course, in the process of trying to double their megatonnage and cut in half their warning time to overcome a generation-long nuclear strategic superiority that the United States had. And when we confronted them and demanded the dismantling of those missiles, we did so with very high confidence that they had no alternative, because we had anywhere from a fourfold to a tenfold superiority in nuclear capability. We knew it and they knew it. They tested our will at the conventional level by sending their ships to the blockade line and finding us firm of purpose. They backed down and we gave them a graceful and a face-saving way to do so. By 8 years later, in the Jordan crisis, the Soviets, feeling that they ought to be perceived as superior in the conventional field, initiated a test, the Syrian invasion of Jordan. Three things went wrong there with their calculus. The Jordanian army fought better than the Soviets had calculated. The Israelis moved their forces northward and were clearly getting ready to play a role. And the United States, still having about a 50% probability of prevailing in a conventional war, reinforced its Sixth Fleet, and that calculus of factors led the Soviets to persuade the Syrians to withdraw and to promise to improve their training and replace their equipment. 3 years later, this job had been done. The Syrians and the Egyptians attacked by surprise, fooling both U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence, using Soviet tactics of lots of exercises and then suddenly pouncing. And at that time, Israel was very nearly undone. The United States, through airlift and sea lift, gave them enough equipment by stripping our active forces to turn it around. As the Israelis surrounded the Egyptian Third Army, the Soviets sent a brutal ultimatum to the United States, one which didn't even say, "Dear Mr. President," just "Mr. President," an ultimatum which made it clear that we were to order the Israelis to release the Egyptian Third Army, or the Soviets would go in with or without us. And I know of no one in government at the time who believed that we had the military capability to do anything except what we did, to go on an alert and immediately to accommodate. In another 5 years, the situation will be clear to everyone instead of just to those who were in the scene at the time.
If I may intercede, I'd like to answer that, because you've mentioned accommodation several times, and I think I have a little bit different... Maybe we can have a debate here. A little bit different view on that. I feel very strongly that one of the big problems we have, and I think one of the good things that you did in the Navy, was build morale. And I think morale is one of the most important things of any fighting force. I think Napoleon said the ratio of materiel to morale was 1-3. He'd rather have morale, 300% morale, than he would on materiel. It seems to me that part of our problem, and it's a very serious problem, is that it is very difficult to have that kind of morale in a place like Korea as an American, or to have it in South Vietnam. The other side is always going to have much higher morale. They're much more involved. There are much higher stakes for them. And I think NATO's the same way. I think NATO would be much stronger in a conventional force if the NATO allies were contributing a lot more, taking it a lot more seriously, and much more involved in a conventional manner. But they kind of rely on us as the paternalistic big daddy who's going to come in when it gets tough. I think in the long run we're not doing anybody any favor by relying on us that much, because I'm not sure we can really pull people out, which is what I think you're saying, is no longer can we pull those strings unless we want to go to nuclear strings, and I think we never want to go to that. That's just much too dangerous. But I think that if we're really worried about the free world posture, which we should be, then we should be saying to other members of the free world, they're going to have to do their part, that it just can't be the United States being the big umbrella organization for everyone. And unless they're really contributing, we're going to get put in these positions. But I think at any time, there are alternatives. I mean, before we ever had to go to a nuclear holocaust of some sort, we could do certain things that are in between. We could explode a nuclear weapon somewhere way far away from everybody, just to show people that, you know, we knew what was going on. And we could deploy a bomber, which you can always turn around. Or we could, there's some middle ground that I think could be explored before we have to totally capitulate. I think Korea and this accommodation thing that you're talking about is probably the most fearsome thing that we have right at the moment. And I'm very fearful about having tactical nuclear weapons on the border in Korea that could be overrun very shortly if the North Koreans decided to move, and what would our president do? I would take those off the border. I don't think they should be at the border. I don't think we should use nuclear weapons in Korea. And I think that if we really want to talk about when we should use nuclear weapons, okay, we shouldn't use them there, in my estimation, even if the other side wins. If the other side wins, it's going to be partly our fault, maybe, for not having built up the South Koreans enough, or not having them feel strongly enough to want to save their nation. But I'm not sure we can go around saving everybody's nation for them, mainly because of that very important factor of morale that you just can't measure.
I certainly strongly endorse the point that morale can do an awful lot. I know the Marines very well, for example, and have a son who's a Marine captain, and I would bet that one U.S. Marine division could whip any three Soviet divisions and maybe any five. The problem is that the United States has 16 divisions and the Soviets have over 100. And I'm not sure when it gets up to 8 or 10 to 1 that it would be all that easy. Pat, I worry a little bit about your warlike suggestion that we maybe explode that atomic weapon. I would, if I were the president having to make that decision, not even do that. I would begin at that point to do what presidents should have been doing since 1969, to report accurately to the American people what the facts are.
Thank you. We'll take a question on my right now.
My name is Emily Aitken, and I would like to address both Admiral Zumwalt and Congresswoman Schroeder. You both seem to agree that America needs stronger conventional forces. But if this is so, then what should be the limits on these forces?
What should be the limits? Was that what you said?
Yes.
I don't know exactly what you mean. You mean numerically or?
The limits on the expansion of them.
Of the expansion of them?
Of forces.
Well, I might just make a quick statement on that. I think that the Secretary of Defense has reported accurately that the Soviets have been outspending us since 1971 in conventional and strategic forces. In the case of ships, they have been spending 50% more for construction of new ships than we have for nearly 9 years. This Soviet Union, with half our gross national product, is putting over 12% of its GNP into military capability, and we're putting less than 6. I believe that we ought to be putting a little more money into our budget than the Soviets are putting in. And I would strongly advocate that that situation be achieved not by spending more U.S. money, but by getting the Soviets to spend less, by putting all of those negotiating chips on the table that I discussed earlier. But if the Soviets are not willing to do it that way, then I believe for the expenditure of just a little under a percent a year, more than we are spending of our GNP, we could then force the Soviets to join us in true arms control, which would reduce the expenditures over the long haul for both sides.
I would say, first of all, Washington, I think, has a real problem in that we tend to become a scenario factory. So we want to manufacture all sorts of scenarios. And when you're looking at the entire world, we can manufacture scenarios from here to kingdom come. And on that basis, we'll never be able to come up with the forces to fight everywhere just because numerically in the world we don't have the numbers. We also have an incredible technology fetish in this country, and it's a very hard thing. Our military has bought it, too. Bigger, better, faster, more. We've got weapons that are so gold-plated that can do everything in the world. The only problem is you only need that maybe 1% of the time, and the cost investment's phenomenal. It seems to me that in building up the conventional forces, what we need to do is emphasize more their morale, their importance as a fighting force. I'm concerned about the volunteer army. If you look at the brochures, you never see the mention that they might have to fight. You would think you were going off on a world cruise, you were going to college, you were going to a country club. But heaven forbid we should mention that. Those kind of things worry me very much. I think we also have to give a message to our allies. And this is where I feel, as a politician, feel very strongly. When I look at our European allies and what they spend for defense, they don't spend nearly the amount of their gross national product we do. They're able to take their tax dollars and give their people better housing, better medical care, better all sorts of things, because we're picking up part of their defense bill. So obviously they love it. I would love it if they'd pick up ours. But I think we have to tell them we cannot do it all. And I think Vietnam is a classic example. No one has ever accused us in Vietnam of not having the best trained and the best equipped army the world has ever seen. I mean, there's no question our equipment versus the North Vietnamese equipment was, you know, it was like comparing apples and oranges. We had everything in the world, and yet we couldn't quite do it. So it is important to have the morale of the people that you're helping. The Russians seem to be able to gain allies that fight themselves, and they send them a few tanks or something. Maybe it's because they're much firmer with their allies and don't allow their allies to become so dependent upon them to bail them out all the time. So I think in the long run, we're really not doing our allies a favor. And as we refocus on conventional warfare, which isn't nearly as glamorous as B-1 bombers and AWACSs and all these fun things nobody can really find a mission for, but, you know, they'll be just marvelous. The AWACS, I think, is going to be $132 million, and they're still looking for a mission for it. But, you know, we keep wanting to, because there's money involved in that. There's companies and all sorts of things. Let's try tanks, rifles, morale, divisions, men, you know, deployment, working, that kind of thing, and regular ships that float rather than ones that do everything else. Let's try those, and let's also tell our allies that they're just going to have to do more because we can't come to bail them out every time anything gets tough, and they can spend their money for whatever they want. And I think that's part of it. Thank you.
Take the next question on my left.
Bill Stallings. I'd like to ask Representative Schroeder whether if the Soviet Union continues to outspend the United States in defense, whether Congress will reverse the declining budgets or just let that happen.
Well, I tend to disagree a little bit with some of the things that Admiral Zumwalt has said. I don't think the Russians are that far ahead of us. Yes, they have more troops, but they have a phenomenal number of borders to deploy troops along. They've got to go from China all the way around through Europe, so they have a phenomenal borderline that they're watching. I think the CIA, Colby's testimony and everyone, is technology in Russia is behind us. I object seriously to detente because I think what we're doing is helping them with their technology so they can catch up, and we're financing it, which I think is utter insanity. But that we're still ahead, and I think that we can continue to do that. I think we can get a lot more dollar for the money. There's an incredible amount of waste in the defense budget, and I think that we can take an awful lot of that out. I think also, it shouldn't be so much as our spending more. I think we're now spending an incredible amount of defense and getting very little defense for it, in essence. And we've also got to emphasize that other countries that we are supposedly helping must spend more, too.
Thank you. Take the next question on my left.
Benson Chertok, a professor of physics at American University here in Washington. I brought some of my class with me here today. One of the things that I'm disappointed in is that there was not an advocate on the platform for the flexible use of nuclear weapons. We thought this was going to be part of the debate. I'm delighted that both of you are against it. What I would like to know is how this issue, which is being raised in Washington, can be defeated now politically. Let me just briefly expand on the comment that Congressman Schroeder made earlier about what this kind of a flexible option would do. Admiral Zumwalt mentioned that we may be facing in 4 or 5 years a situation with the Soviet Union where we would have to back down. As I understand it, the Secretary of Defense would like to present the President with the flexible option of responding to a Soviet provocation by, for example, surgically striking at their missile fields. They might decide to do that with us. And the statement that was made a year or so ago was that the collateral damage, meaning civilian casualties, would be very minor because these weapons are so precise that they can land in a backyard, so to speak. And now calculations that have been done for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by a committee headed by Sidney Drell, another physicist, have come up with an estimate that the civilian casualties in this country from a Soviet missile attack on our missile fields could be as large as 18 million. And depending on the winds and so forth, if the missile fields in Missouri were attacked, that people in Texas, for example, could die from the radioactive fallout. I'm sure the American people aren't willing to accept this kind of a situation, or I think the question that goes further is really whether we're going to start playing the martial music and develop a tremendous civil defense program so that in the face of a provocation that, in fact, this country can go underground. So really, the question, I think, for both of you would be, first, how will one politically defeat the flexible nuclear response option, which is now current in Washington, that I understand is favored by a few people, but a few very influential people? And then secondly, are we going to, Admiral Zumwalt in particular, go into a large civil defense program so that if we face the Armageddon in 4 or 5 years, that this country can go underground? Thank you.
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that question. I, for example, some of the things that are going on right now that are being discussed is there's great enthusiasm for development of the cruise missile. And as you know, the cruise missile is supposed to be absolutely marvelous because you can't tell it from a goose on a radar, which is tremendous for the cruise missile. But it isn't too good if you're Russia waiting in, and the thing is, as you read it on your radar screen, what if you see a goose as a cruise missile and decide to then react? I mean, the instability that this all creates as we move further and further down this technology collision course
is cheap, and I think one of the big problems now is economics, and when you get into things that are cost-effective, if we're going to take less than 1% of our GNP and increase that, I think if Admiral Zumwalt converted that into dollars, people would be astounded to know that what less than 1% of our GNP is. That's, of course, one of the big problems is economics now. What do you do faced with the realities of a fixed budget?
Well, what I was trying to say, though, is I think that this whole reliance on this flexible targeting and counterforce, and I assume you're referring to Schlesinger's statement this summer where he said it was conceivable we might even use our strategic forces, which was a new breakthrough in the counterforce thing, added to the cruise missile, added to all of the different technologies that are going on and trying to test MARV, which would also be more like 99% effective if we had it, is going to create an incredible instability at the nuclear threshold level, because if you were the Russians and you know that we have these things, the launch on warning things becomes incredibly conceivable. It's also conceivable they will pull all of their missiles out of the silos and put them, you know, have mobile launches so that all the stuff that we devised this year won't work next year. So we keep going down this incredible, insane path, developing all these things that we're probably never going to use in most wars, and if we ever have to use them, it's all over anyway, probably. So it seems to me that so much of our time is spent discussing scenarios that we should hope never happen, and we should be more on the conventional forces, and they've suffered a great amount from that standpoint. I cannot articulate the case for counterforce because I don't believe it. I think some of the things that we are calling tactical nuclear weapons don't even qualify as tactical nuclear weapons. And let's talk about the Pershing missile, which have been in the press. We've got Pershing missiles in Germany that will reach Russia. So I don't think you'd really call those tactical nuclear weapons because they can reach the homeland. So I think even our own definitions, our forward base systems, we have bombers that can both hit battlegrounds and the Russians have been wanting to talk about those. We haven't wanted to talk about those. I think we should be clearer in our delineations, and it's just a bad area to be fuzzy in.
I have a somewhat different view of the problem. It seems to me that in order to understand the infernal complexities of this debate, one really has to go back and examine the rather tremendous efforts that the United States has made through several administrations to try to be reasonable. Immediately after the fright of the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy and Secretary McNamara sought to initiate a dialogue with the Russians, pointing out that we were both headed in a direction that could lead to mass destruction, and stating that, you know, the best of all possible worlds would be to figure out a way to cap this race and begin to reduce the arms and to prevent proliferation and so forth, and that as a first step, the United States was going to do the following things. It was going to announce the number of missiles that it would build. It was going to keep them small and clean, and I recognize that those are dirty words to use when one talks about anything that kills millions of people, but in the dialogue of nuclear analysts, and as you'll see in a moment, they were, and that we urged the Russians to be aware of this and to do the same thing so that the Russians would know that the missiles we were building were incapable, with the size of their warheads and the accuracies, of destroying Soviet missiles in a first strike. The Soviets treated this dialogue as a monologue. They did not communicate back. They proceeded to build huge missiles, dirty missiles, missiles of the category of 100 times the destructive power of our own, missiles which would, unlike ours, through their radioactivity, kill people wherever the radioactivity drifts. Ours have been designed not to do that same thing. And so you had a world in which the United States was trying to put some rational cap on a very irrational concept, and the Soviet Union has proceeded to build this other kind of a system. And now they are matching it with accuracy improvements and MIRV warheads, which they say to us in their strategic negotiations with us. They say they intend to use to get what they call a war-winning capability, if they can. Now, I agree that neither side has it today. I agree that I strongly believe that today the exchange, under the terms I've outlined, would kill 10 to 20 times as many Americans as it does Russians. I believe that the situation will get worse in the future, and I believe that the Americans have got to understand that in order for us to change that situation and get to the kind of a world that we all want to have, a world in which there is a reduction in the arms race, a reduction in the numbers of strategic nuclear missiles, a reduction in the number of people that would be killed through miscalculation, we've got to have all our blue chips on the negotiating table and report the facts.
Thank you. We have time for maybe a couple short questions. I'll take the questioner on my right.
Admiral Zumwalt, when you were discussing the Soviets, you mentioned that they're dealing with a patient adversary, one who's got a more subjective plan for control, dealing with economics and things like that. What plan do we have, or what position would you hold for using nuclear weapons against the Red Chinese, where they seem to be much less patient?
Well, I have not called for use of nuclear weapons against the Soviets, and I don't call for the use of nuclear weapons against the Chinese. I believe that the Chinese are today de jure members of the communist bloc, but de facto allies of the United States. They fear the Soviets so much that they are putting 20% of their much smaller GNP into military capability, and they have urged us to keep our forces in Korea and Japan and even in Taiwan and in Thailand. And they have said to us, they said to our NATO allies, the Turks and the Greeks, you've got to get along, you've got to keep NATO strong. When I was in Iceland 2 years ago, the Chinese ambassador to Iceland was urging them to let us keep our base there because he wants to keep NATO strong. I believe that our interests will continue to remain in general confluence with the Chinese until they become much less afraid of the Soviets through the acquisition of much more military power than they have, and I think that's at least 15 years in the future, and I believe that we will know when it comes because they will come to us and say, kindly to carry out your commitment on Taiwan.
And I wouldn't advocate using it against the Chinese either.
In the interest of survival, I'd like to take this one last question, which was sent up, since there's no place to hide. In the case of a nuclear war, what cities would be the first to be bombed in the United States or the USSR?
Well, in the case of a nuclear war, which was carried out on the sophisticated basis of some of the advocates, the cities wouldn't be hit in the first exchange. It would be the strike against hard targets, that is, the silos and the military targets, leaving the cities hostage. In the event of the kind of breakdown of command and control and terrible overreaction which Congresswoman Schroeder has cited, or in the event of a failure after that first exchange to have a surrender by one side or the other, then, in my judgment, every single city of over 100,000 in both nations would be hit. In the case of the Soviet Union, most of those would have been evacuated. In the case of the United States, none of them would have been. I repeat, I don't think that day is ever going to come. I think the president, faced with the two alternatives, is going to choose the other.
I repeat, I wish that day would never come. I'm very fearful when we start talking about clean weapons and, you know, surgical, tactical, nuclear, things like that. So I think that we get closer and closer in trying to make the nuclear weapons look more like conventional weapons. Again, as we blur that line, it's very conceivable we could once start down that garden path, and once you've started down it, you don't stop. I think it's hard to know which cities would ever be hit at any point. I think the thing to emphasize, though, is even if both sides knocked out each other's land-based missiles, we haven't done anything about the submarines, which is the most important part and the most invulnerable part of the triad. And they're still sitting out there with theirs, and they could target whatever's left over. I remember once of saying to Admiral Zumwalt, I was glad he had women on ships, because what an awful feeling if we were down to the very last time in the worst possible scenario with our last submarines firing, at least we'd have women who might carry on civilization.
I might just say that the only disagreement I would have with Pat on that is that to report a story, which is symptomatic of the kind of phenomenon we're dealing with. Those submarines, it's true, would survive a first strike. But those submarines, if the Soviets have continued to cheat, as they are, could very well find their missiles shot down by anti-ballistic missile systems produced in violation of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. We will never cheat. The Soviets are cheating. Now, let me report then what eventuates. In 1962, when I went to the 18-nation disarmament conference, I listened to Ambassador Zorin of the Soviet Union describe that what we ought to do is get together and both sides agree to destroy our missiles overnight. And then the next day it would be a brave new world. And let's just do it. Let's agree today to do it. And I went up to him during the coffee break and asked the interpreter to translate the following question to him. I said, Ambassador, let's assume that both sides do so in true good faith, and let's assume that you're really sincere, and let's assume that we both destroy our missiles overnight, and all our nuclear weapons. And then let's assume that quite by accident, you Soviets discovered that you had overlooked 100 missiles with nuclear warheads on them. What do you think would happen? He got the translation and he looked around to see if there were any press in attendance, and he spoke in Russian, and the answer came back: first, we would tell you we had found them. Second, we would deliver our ultimatum. And I said, as one professional to another, I thank you very much.
That's the frankest answer a Russian ever gave. Well, in conclusion, I'd like to thank Pat Schroeder and Admiral Zumwalt for being here today and for fielding the very tough questions that concern us all very informatively.